It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis joins us from the show floor at Facebook's Developers Conference, F8. We will talk about all the announcements Facebook made today and yesterday with, of course, Jeff, Matthew Ingram from Fortune.com, and Stacey Higginbotham. Twig is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 401, recorded Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. A new interface paradigm for your friends. This Week in Google is brought to you by LegalZoom. LegalZoom's helped more than a million people with their DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, and more. Visit LegalZoom.com and enter Twig at checkout for special savings. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at QuickenLoans.com/Twig. And by NatureBox, delicious snacks made from high-quality ingredients. Eat well and feel better. Visit naturebox.com/twit to save 50% on your first order. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, which will be probably a lot of This Week in Facebook this week. Joining us from Facebook's F8 Developers Conference, Jeff Jarvis. He's in the lobby right now. It sounds like he's coming to us via Gemini 8, somebody in the chat room said, but that's good enough. We'll take it. Thank you.
Thank you.
For being here. He's stepped away from the media stage. You were presenting moments ago, so.
Yeah, about the News Integrity Initiative we talked about last week.
Yeah,
so that's over.
But there's a lot of interest in that.
I hope so, yeah.
Facebook's a partner in that, of course.
Yes.
Also with us, of course, Stacey Higginbotham. Stacey on IoT.com and IoTpodcast.com from Austin, Texas, which is where Jeff's going to be tomorrow, I guess. So you're going to invite you and Jeff over and have a barbecue?
Breakfast tacos.
Ooh, breakfast tacos.
Yum. That sounds good. And from Fortune.com, Matthew Ingram is also here from the northern regions of Canada. And we're all here to talk about, of course, many, many things. But let's first get a report from F8. We covered the keynote yesterday, and a lot of attention paid to a couple of things. Mark Zuckerberg and company announced a new platform in the Facebook app for augmented reality using the camera. A platform in the sense that developers will have a way to access the camera and information and add filters and things to it. Some people said it was, you know, really a catch-up to Snapchat's filters and world filters, which Snapchat announced the day before. They also announced the VR Spaces, which is a beta version of an Oculus Rift program that allows you to finally be in the same space as somebody else wearing Oculus Rift and interact with them. So what do you think, Jeff?
So I think Farhad Manjoo in the Times this morning had the best piece that I've read and probably the best thing I think he's ever written about Facebook today. And he starts off, and they're probably not going to like it very much, but he starts off saying, yeah, okay, so Mark's a thief. So they took this stuff from Snapchat. They took other stuff from other places. They bought other companies. But then by the end, he says, and so what? Steve Jobs stole, Bill Gates stole. This is where it is. The power of Facebook is the network. And I think he was really right. Chris Cox showed a good slide yesterday in the keynotes where he showed one axis was how they go from one-on-one relationships to your community, up through your geography, to government, to media to government, right? And on the other axis was all the tools they have, from text to photos all the way to AR, VR. And what really struck me is they missed a third axis. And the third axis is what Facebook really is, which is that it connects people to people. And that's what Farhad is really talking about. That's the power of Facebook. That allows them to do anything they want. So they took features from Snapchat. Tough. It's a competitive world. And maybe they weren't the most innovative in the world. Maybe they're following, but they have the network that is phenomenal. And so, yes, they have the power to bring rainbow puke to the world.
Right. Well, you know, it reminds me of Matthew is Microsoft in its heyday in the 90s.
Yeah.
They embraced
and extend.
Yes. And extend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
That's
yeah.
exactly what I thought of too. And to be fair, I think they did copy stories, right? They copied it whole, it's bolus. Yep. They've copied lots of other things. But what they are talking about with augmented reality, they didn't just develop that stuff a week ago because they saw that Snapchat was working on it. These are things that Facebook and just about everyone, I think, has been thinking about for quite some time. So it does look as though, you know, they're duplicating things that Snapchat is doing. I think they both seem to be moving along the same track, which is to use the camera as the easiest sort of interface to a virtual world. That just makes sense. They've also, their vision, I think, goes significantly farther than Snapchat's has, or at least has so far. So are they duplicating each other? Yes. But I don't think it's just Facebook is out of ideas, and so they're copying whatever Snapchat does.
Farhad Manju quotes Miranda Kerr, Evan Spiegel's fiancé, in an interview with the Times of London. She said she couldn't stand Facebook's behavior. Can they not innovate? Do they have to steal all of my partner's ideas? She asked. When you directly copy someone, that's not innovation. To which I say, writes Farhad, meh, there are lots of different kinds of innovation in the tech industry. Coming up with something first is not the only kind. One of the reasons Microsoft got dinged for this, or is it dunged for this? Dunged is because it looked like they were being a bully, right? They used their market share to invest, you know, to approach companies, say, we'd like to see more of that, and then steal it. Or they'd buy companies that were competitive and engulf them. To some degree, Facebook's done this. But I don't think Facebook's being a bully here. And I think you're right, no. Jeff, that they had to have been working on this all along. It wasn't like, oh, we like this worldviews. Can we do that tomorrow?
Right.
But the innovation they showed today in the keynote, where they talked about direct connections to your brain and AR glasses in our lifetime that are comfortable and really work, and another things that show that they are truly innovating in gigantic ways. And Snapchat, bless their soul, came up with a mechanism that young people like to communicate with each other. They did a brilliant job of it. But in a competitive world, you see the best ideas and you use them. How innovative is Facebook? We'll see over the next 20 years. It's only just had its bar mitzvah.
Well, you mentioned that today's speech that the CTO of Facebook was there and did a good job of mapping out the future. But there also was towards the end, and this is a little bit of flying car stuff, right? But we have a clip of, I'm not sure who it is, but I'm sure she'll be identified in the clip, talking about typing with your mind and listening with your skin. Let's take a look.
This is the head of Building 8, who's the Huawei lab.
Regina Dunn.
Regina Dunn.
Yes. Yeah.
She cannot move or speak, but she is typing with her mind, not with eye blanks, with her mind. An array of electrodes the size of a pea has been implanted where her brain would normally control her motor functions. The electrodes record her neurons firing when she imagines moving the cursor. Then the computer learns to move it for her. Using this system, she can type 8 words per minute. She is typing at 8 words per minute. Directly with her brain.
That is pretty impressive.
Now,
this Regina Dugan, she also talked a little bit about listening with your skin. This is not, by the way, she was at the ATAP group at Google, and the director of DARPA. She only joined Facebook recently, right? I think fairly recently, maybe a year ago. So
I did mention that I'm not sure people typing with their mind exactly what they're thinking on Facebook is going to be a great development for humanity.
It's a little too close to that already.
Yeah.
Nothing in the, no inhibition whatsoever. You, Jeff, were talking today about the Tau initiative that you're doing along with Craig Newmark and Facebook and a few other partners to improve integrity in the news. What was the reaction to your talk today?
I don't know because I ran out of the room to come here, so it looks like I'm suspiciously escaping.
He's dressed in black and he ran out.
Yeah. I hope they knew that I was not escaping the wrath of the media. No, there were shakes of head and other things. And Facebook, to its credit, is trying to be more open about its roadmap with publishers. The session I was just in is off the record, so I can't say anything. One thing that I know that we publishers have been asking for, they just said they're going to do, and they're listening to publishers more. There's a long way to go still, but I think we see progress. I was give Google credit too for starting this path and setting the way. I think both platforms are trying very hard to make friends in media, and proof's in the pudding. We'll see, but it's also up to us to collaborate with them.
You know, I mean, some of the so we have a broad mix of stuff from today's keynote. You said today unfortunately we chose to cover the first day keynote. Maybe not unfortunately, because that was the announcement of some big new Facebook technologies that you can use right now.
I love Facebook's forward-looking stuff. They really do a good job investing, much like Google. Remember back in the day, we were like, Google's infrastructure is really its competitive advantage. Yeah. I know.
Google Island. But, we all wanted to move to Google Island.
Yeah, but let's face it. Facebook has a lot of failures under its belt, too. Far more failures than successes.
Yeah, I think they deserve credit for that.
They try stuff.
For a big company, they try and fail at stuff all the time.
Right.
And they invest so much money in the hardware infrastructure to get it right and to think about not just their platform and the software side. They invest in the infrastructure, and they're going even further down with their broadband efforts. And not all of that's going to work. But the way they look at the world, they see that we're moving to this massively distributed computing architecture or infrastructure. And they're like, okay, how can we make it even extend it further and make it more resilient? And if you look at it in cheaper, I should say in cheaper, those are kind of the three things. So
Facebook handed out 4,360 degree cameras. Did you get yours, Jeff?
Actually, I'm not sure. There's a bag they gave me in a thing yesterday that was back in the hotel.
I haven't even looked at your bag. It's the Gyroptic. There's one of two kind of very popular 360 degree cameras. This one attaches to your phone. It came out in December, $250, 1920 by 960. Anyway, get ready for an onslaught of 360.
They also showed a new 24 camera and a 6 camera rigs for VR for 360, where the 24 camera is high overlap of pixels, which enables them to basically, they did a lot of work on this with AI and even 2D photos, being able to navigate around the photo and understand that. They showed a lot of AI stuff, understanding people and their actions in a room. Pretty impressive.
So it's this today was obviously a little more VR than yesterday. Yesterday really was about AR, and it almost felt like a somewhat of a pivot. Of course, three years ago, they acquired Oculus Rift, nominally a VR company, but as many have pointed out, VR is just a subset of a total of what AR can do. And they really talked a lot about AR yesterday in more than just, Snapchat-style filters, although I imagine the first things we'll see will be mostly that.
And I actually think if Facebook got anything from Snapchat, it was, my sense is, I don't have any inside information on this, but my sense is that what they got was, in the short term, and particularly for augmented reality, we should just stick to the camera. Like, everybody's got one. It's relatively easy to do. So instead of leaping forward to headsets and eyeglasses and so on, even Zuckerberg said, we decided some interesting stuff is happening with the camera. It's right here in your hand. Let's see what we can do with that.
He even said the camera box is more important than the text box and input. And that's clearly another Snapchat view. But you're right. The camera is the mechanism to augment the world.
Well, it's something in everybody's hand right now. I suspect this is Apple's plan, too, this fall with the next iPhone. And so this is, it's clearly kind of entry-level tech, just as Oculus Rift, frankly, is entry-level VR tech. But everybody has it.
So I don't plan to be puking rainbows soon or putting headsets on. Stacey, what do you think your daughter is going to think of this AR stuff on Facebook? Is it old hat? Is it new?
Well, so my daughter won't be on Facebook is my guess. It'll be yeah. like her equivalent of LinkedIn or something. I don't know. For olds.
You know, I thought that too. We had a bunch of high school kids from Perth, Australia in yesterday. And Megan thought, as I did, probably most of them are using Snapchat. Maybe they're using Instagram, but they're unlikely to be using their parents' social network. Every one of them is on Facebook. And this is, I think, to Farhad Manju's point, which is the size and scope of the Facebook network is such that you, even if you don't like embrace it because it, your parents are there also, you can't not be on there.
Our right. teenage daughter quit, deleted her account. She was, I think, 17. And within a matter of months, she had started her account again.
Yeah, everybody hates Facebook.
But yeah, she didn't want to be there, right. but she felt like she had to be. So yes. it's like email is right. for us.
Right, right.
You have to do it.
Yeah, so I suspect, and I don't, you know, this is the very interesting question. You're supposing, Stacey, that in 10 years, well, your daughter's, what, 7? So in 6 years?
She's 10.
10. Oh, well, yeah. sooner than you think. There'll be something else. Just as Facebook replaced MySpace, but I think you do get to a point with the network effect where when you have nearly 2 billion monthly active users, it's pretty hard for somebody else to come along and steal them away, I think.
I think what will happen is we'll graduate beyond these fake social networks that are like Facebook. So what will happen isn't that there'll be another Facebook. There's going to be just something that's a better evolution. And right. maybe it's like, I think... Facebook's right to focus on the camera, if only because there are plenty of times when, think about how voice evolved. You started out just asking for, I remember trying speech to text kind of commands back in like 2008, and they were clunky and lame, and you just say something and it would happen. I think you're going to get to these points where, yeah, you see something and you're like, if you hold your camera up in front of it, you're going to be like, oh, look, there's something there and it's more information. And then
yes.
it'll gradually envelop more and more things. And then mm-hmm. it'll become instinctive to, at some point, to look up and be like, oh, hey, look, info, cool. And that's when we're going to see the glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if they shipped those today, wouldn't they sell like hotcakes already?
I would buy some.
Glasses?
Who wouldn't?
I would.
Yeah.
A lot. So people outside the tech world... Like, I mean, think about Snapchat's glasses, and it sounds really cool, and you and I, and we would all buy them and be like, nifty, but real people have limited income, and they may not want to spend it on what feels like a gimmicky device.
What if when you're buying sunglasses, which you're going to wear anyway, it happens to have that capability that you can see Yelp reviews or other kinds of information? I thought
that's going to be a few years down the road. Oh, yeah. But yes, that's exactly how it's going to play out.
I think
out.
That's what people want.
I mean, Mark Zuckerberg mentioned one of my use cases, which is you're in Italy, you know, you've read about the Colosseum, but you know zero about it, and you look at it and information pops up about it. That would be hugely useful. Do you need to buy it? Maybe not. Maybe you rent it, but it'd still be hugely useful.
Well, Go ahead, Stacey.
I was going to say that gets to this idea of innovation, who's copying whom, because this is not a new concept. And the key is figuring out the right time to launch something and the right form factor that people,
right.
that will get people to adopt it.
Right.
And Facebook has a lot of those advantages.
Right.
And I think there is one argument. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead, Matthew. No, you go ahead.
No, Jeff, you're our guest of honor because you're leaving soon.
No. I apologize, and I apologize to everybody for being worse than usual interruptions because I can't. There's latency. So I'm trying to call a picture of the things that are needed for AR glasses to really work. And let me call up this picture because it was a really interesting line. Well, I said one thing is that today the pixel density that we can get is 15 pixels per degree. In the near future, it'll be 120. Field of view is about 90 degrees. In the future, it'll go to 220 to 330. The depth of focus is fixed at 2 meters. In the future, it'll be variable from 25 centimeters to...
We're losing.
Oops.
We lost his signal. That's all right. We'll continue on, and we'll get him back. It's clear that you need better batteries because obviously this is going to have to be detached. You need high-speed connectivity everywhere. One of the things that bothered me a little bit when in Mark's presentation yesterday is the notion that you could leave little messages and notes around as you're going around, which is going to really open. I mean, if we think we have problems with trolling with Twitter right now, at least it's constrained to Twitter. Imagine it's going to be like digital graffiti everywhere.
Right.
We have to solve that issue.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm not sure that that's a great thing is to be able to graffiti the world in augmented reality, no matter, you know.
Yeah, and actually Matt Honan, I think it was writing about how Facebook, you know, paints these beautiful pictures about, right. You could leave public art in public spaces.
Yeah,
you could also paint a swastika, you know, on a famous painting. This is going to happen, right? One of the lessons.
Let's face it. There'll be penises everywhere.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Remember Second Life?
That's
one of the lessons, I think, of the Facebook
right.
killing, if you want to call it that, is
exactly.
Facebook continually sort of releases these gee whiz technologies and then has to catch up. Oh, my God. Human beings are doing horrible things with our service.
Well, this is the blind spot all technologists, and I am one of them, have, is we get excited, we look at the potential for these new technologies, and then we forget that there are many bad humans that will inevitably find a way to twist this and make it unusable. And so maybe augmented reality is only great in our dreams. I mean, I guess we now know enough to be worried about this.
I think you have to think about... You know, you have to be prepared not to get depressed and think, well, we shouldn't do this because people might do bad things.
Yeah.
But you have to think it through, at least consider what could be some of the bad things and what could you do to prevent that. And I wonder if maybe Facebook doesn't do that second part as well.
Well, maybe. I mean, it feels like I know we want this maximum internet-like freedom to do what we want and leave our messages. But what's more likely is that, especially initially, we'll have maybe it's software platforms or packages that you buy. So if you're going to Italy, maybe you buy the Lonely Planet's
the
Italy
package,
AR software.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm not so stressed about that because I don't see something like leaving messages for people actually getting implemented anytime soon.
But
maybe
remember,
I'm crazy
that's what
stupid.
Facebook offers, though. I mean, that's what Facebook does. So naturally, that's what they're going to show.
You know what that reminded me of was Microsoft Bob. Do you remember? You could actually leave little virtual notes.
Yeah, little post-its on people's documents.
That was a reality opportunity missed.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. The timing of this is poor from Facebook's point of view, but it does bring, you know, this Facebook murderer brings home exactly this issue, which is you can create live video, you can create postable video, but when you have that many users, it's very difficult to create the safeguards that prevent it from being, you know, appalling.
And if you go back, you look at what Mark Zuckerberg said when Facebook Live launched, someone had a quote. He said, "This allows you to be unfiltered and to create experiences that are raw and visceral." Well, that sure is true. Like, that sure is what people are doing.
I wonder if he feels like he's learned his lesson or if he's...
I don't know. I doubt it. I mean, I still think he's fundamentally optimistic about these technologies, and that's good. I just don't know. Like, how do you stop someone from uploading those types of videos?
Yeah. Jeff, are people talking about that Facebook murderer at all there, or is that... I mean,
they are. And the interesting thing is that I think there's a big difference in expectation. I think that, frankly, some people thought that they actually did a good job getting that video down in moderately short order.
About half an hour.
Other people
thought,
of course, that. Yeah. Some people said that
it wasn't reported for an hour.
Oh, okay.
I heard people say that maybe all videos should go to a small group, but then the chances of someone reporting something bad are far lessened. I think those who criticize Facebook on this, Justin Osofsky wrote a very good post that went through the TikTok exactly what happened when. I think they're honest about saying they need to get better, and that's fine. But the extension of the complaints is nobody should have live. Because one horrible person came along and did this, I think we wouldn't agree with that. So we live in an imperfect world, and the features that reflect this world will be imperfect along with it.
I thought it was interesting that, like, sorry, go ahead, Stace.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there have been one or two cases of people, like, attacking news anchors while they were doing live reports.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
So
not just that, YouTube has had this kind of stuff for like how long now?
That's true.
It's not just Facebook. Yeah.
That's true. But the difference is Facebook Live, although YouTube now has YouTube Live. There's Periscope.
But this wasn't even live.
Right. No, it wasn't.
It was reported at first, yeah.
Yeah, and he did go on live later, talking about it.
The thing I thought was interesting was that video of the killing was up for an hour before anybody reported it.
That's
according
very
to Facebook's
strange.
Timeline.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah, and the issue there is the public. Is who does he know? What are our norms? How does this operate? Facebook, I think as soon as they're alerted, will act. Do we alert them? What I don't see the data on is how many people saw it. More than the time is what was the actual exposure of the thing.
So the first video
actually were reported.
The first video went up at 11:09 a.m. with the intent to murder, not reported to Facebook. Second video of the shooting went up at 11:11, 2 minutes later. 11:22, the live stream where he confesses to the murder. 11:27, the live stream ends, and the live video is first reported shortly after. So that wasn't a half an hour. It's 16 minutes after the shooting video. The first reporting of the shooting video was more than an hour later. It was at 1 p.m. Yeah. It was posted at 11:11. It wasn't reported till 1 p.m. And it took them, after it was reported, 23 minutes for Facebook to disable the account.
Which is pretty good.
What do you guys think? Is that a pretty good or is that an awful?
I don't know. It seems a long time.
I think that's pretty good.
I guess.
Really? Well, they have to review it, I assume.
Yeah, but how long does it take to review it? I guess there's a queue of things they have to review. We now know it's a 23-minute queue, I presume, because as soon as you reviewed it, you'd take it down.
I mean, could they do better? Obviously. And I think there's a big debate. Certainly, journalists would like there to be a group of editors who view everything and then say what should go up and what shouldn't. But the fact is Facebook is never going to do that in a million
years.
That's
ridiculous. That's
human
not
beings
scalable.
Don't scale.
No,
right.
No.
So,
and AI is never going to really be good at this because, you know, it's
so it goes from 23 minutes
to 15
minutes
to 20
minutes. Right. What's the real difference? Right. This is the world we live in.
A lot of people saw it tweeted. I mean, I know people who had Twitter autoplay video turned on and were horrified.
Yep.
Because it was tweeted.
It was on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
But who would do that?
It actually took YouTube longer to take it down than it did Facebook.
Who would do that? This is the point,
that's the problem.
People. It's the problem.
And there's been demand on the internet and availability on the internet of, I guess, snuff films or things.
Sure.
But this is what happened. We knew this would happen with the internet. Everything that was hidden under a rock in the hard-to-get-to places is now easily available, and that's the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that's just
And we know that every feature, like Facebook Live, is going to enable some incredibly wonderful things, and it's also going to enable some horrible, offensive, disgusting things.
Because it's a tool.
That's what the internet does.
It's a tool. Right. It doesn't have any particular.
So here's the other thing today. I was really surprised. I imagine there are German lawmakers writing laws right now. Because Facebook went over the line that Google has tickled and not gone over. In today's keynote, they showed AR glasses and they said, and immediately put up a picture, you see a face, and it puts the name next to it. So it used face recognition.
No.
Yeah. Well, every old person next to me said, yay, I can't wait, I can't remember names.
Yeah, me too.
No.
But I can't
Google
remember
deliberately
names,
didn't do that.
I don't want people to be able to have computer-aided access to who I am. Sorry.
In their defense, Facebook does have your social graph, and so it would be trivial for Facebook to say you will only identify people you are
two friends,
know.
Right?
Right.
That's true.
If you could opt in that way,
Google had the tech to do that. What 2 years ago?
Right. They explicitly said we're not going to turn it on. Yeah. I mean, sad to say, the FBI also has that tech, and whether you turn
it on, they sure do.
Yeah. So. Also, today they showed Aquila. In fact, they showed a couple of ways to get internet to people who don't have it. They showed helicopter emergency internet access. And apparently Aquila.
That's a way better name.
I think Tequila would be great. The drone has really, using millimeter wave technology, has really improved the bandwidth. They now are 80 gigabits per second. Wow. And it's also been able to establish a 16 gigabit link between a ground station and a small plane circling 5 miles away. Watch.
A few hundred kilometers of in the atmosphere and try to connect that way. So fiber connects to a microwave dish, a millimeter wave dish, provides connectivity to the first plane, and then other millimeter wave systems or lasers can interconnect and form a network in the sky. So it's a cool idea.
Skynet.
But
yep,
parts of it,
literally,
we've actually started to do. So this is our Aquila system. This is a flight from last year. And to me, this was one of the most incredible moments in my life, where I got to see an aircraft, roughly the wingspan of a Boeing 737, the mass one-third of a Toyota Prius, running on the power of three blow dryers flying in the air.
Wait a minute, they use blow dryers?
But this is not a communications network yet. It needs connectivity. It needs a millimeter wave system. And so we've scoured the earth and tried to find, is there a technology that can go in this aircraft today? And there wasn't. So we had to make a system that was 10 times faster and roughly 10 to 100 times less in terms of mass and power. So I'm really excited that last year we announced that we achieved over a 13 kilometer link, a 20 gigabits per second millimeter wave link. It was a pretty awesome achievement by our team.
Okay, that's not as impressive as
well,
it sounds.
Well, that's old stuff. This is the future.
Okay.
Wait for it.
And I'm really pleased to announce that using that same link, the team almost doubled that rate and achieved 36 gigabits per second over that link. So we beat our own world record.
Is it half duplex? Is that why it's not impressive?
So it's not impressive.
We then flew it in a Cessna on the path to getting it into an Aquila, and we achieved 16 gigabits per second in that system. And then I mentioned optical links that may exist between aircraft, and we actually have built an optical link also on the same 13-kilometer path, and we achieved 80 gigabits per second.
All right, pause this for a second. So why should we be less than joy overjoyed?
It's great, but the technology they're using with the millimeter wave, that is a wavelength that is affected tremendously by things like rain and clouds and plants.
Yeah. Right.
So most of the people in the satellite world that I've talked to who've looked at these plans are like, this is awesome where you don't have cloud cover.
Right.
And we have a lot of cloud cover.
Right.
So that's your moment of, that's my Debbie Downer moment.
Reality.
It is still cool. I'm just like, there's some constraints. And like, I talked to Jay Parikh at Facebook about like how they're doing this, and the technical accuracy they have to get with these lasers is freaking awesome.
Well, they have to be pretty accurate, right? Because you're aiming from one plane to another. They're moving around.
He said it's like hitting a dime from with a gun from miles away.
Yeah. They also are talking about a small helicopter, almost a drone, that could be deployed in emergencies to provide internet access. They call it Tether Tenna. Instant infrastructure in time of crisis. I'm glad. I think it's wonderful Facebook's working on this.
It's kind of amazing. You know, Google has scaled back a lot of the similar types of projects like Project Loon. And I think it's great to see Facebook continuering these kinds of efforts. I imagine.
They scaled it back? Loon?
Yeah, they scaled it back.
Oh. It's another casualty of Ruth Porat.
Yeah.
Chainsaw Ruth Porat, we're calling it.
Budget cuts.
Yeah. What else, Jeff, did you think? I mean, you're there. What else are you seeing that you think is interesting?
I think we've hit most of the high points. I think the VR stuff kind of fascinates me because they're still hot on it, obviously. Oculus is here, but it just didn't – I think you said it right earlier that VR is just a subset of AR, and they're now – concentrating on AR. I think they've recognized the difficulty of the equipment problem. So I wonder about the uptake of VR, just because of a slightly less enthusiastic world for it.
We're going to set up. We have two Oculus Rift systems, and in the next couple of weeks, Nate Olivares-Giles and I are going to set up spaces and meet each other in this virtual reality space. I don't. My initial reaction to this is just pathetic. But
yeah, I can't get my head around the value of this when you can just do a Skype call.
Yeah, there's so many mm-hmm. other ways. Of course, it doesn't make any sense if you're, you know, anywhere near another person to be make.
Right.
But I guess if, you know, Matthew's in Canada and I'm here and we wanted to kind of play ping pong, we could. We'll see. We'll see. It's an interesting.
I continue. Every time I see these technologies, the first thing I think of is people who are, you know, hospitalized or bedridden or,
absolutely.
Or shut-ins. Or I mean,
you can't move.
I can see this type of thing being yeah. a Imagine. Fantastic experience. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, just incredible. But for people who can walk around and leave the building, I'm not sure why would you do that?
Yeah, well, what you know, here's what I worry about. I already see this with younger kids, our 14-year-old. You know, he'll play with his friends, but they're at home playing mm-hmm. a game or in our Minecraft server or whatever. They're all in separate places yeah. talking to each mm-hmm. other, and it yeah. makes me a little bit sad. It's
well, that's us. That's us old.
Maybe
farts.
It's just because I have this preconceived.
Those
notion
damn kids should go outside.
Space. Yeah,
get on my little. Hey,
certainly, they're socializing. Little. They're thrilled.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
he'll even he has a we have a neighbor. His one of his best friends is literally. Next door neighbor.
Next door.
And he'll come over to play and say, okay, I'm going to go home and we'll I'll see you online. And then,
but, Leo, here's my bigger conclusion of coming to this and the lately the hoo-ha over fake news and hate and divisiveness in America and the world. And I don't know if I've said this on the show before or not, but I think that Facebook may be losing a little bit of a sight of its real value, which I said earlier. It's that third axis. It's the connecting people with each other. And Facebook's been accused of creating filter bubbles, and the argument is made that they should expose us to new ideas. But if Facebook is not an ideas platform, no. nor is it an information platform, to be clear. It is a people platform. And what I want Facebook to do is introduce me to strangers and make them less strange.
Oh,
the power that Facebook has is to bring other people's lives together, to bring communities into connection together. There was a great project by a company called Spaceship Media at AL.com in Alabama where they bought 20 Trump voters from Alabama and 20 Clinton voters from San Francisco and brought them together. And the journalists convened their discussion. Yes, they got into arguments, but then they went and asked the journalist for information. They tried to find as close as they could get. They understood each other's arguments. They didn't agree, but that's democracy. That's what Facebook can do. It can convene people. It can make strangers less strange. It can show us other lives. It can allow us to show our own lives.
Should it do that, though, if people don't want to do that? I mean, the people
want to do that.
Do we?
Yeah, we always – that's an
we love,
human.
We love other people's experiences if it's packaged the right way. I mean, think about how well profiles do of people in –
and reality TV.
So it could be they could facilitate this in a way that it would appeal to us, because I think the natural tendency is just to hang out with people you know, and that's the problem. That's the filter bubble itself.
That's the architecture of it. That's my point. That is the architecture. And I think that when Mark Zuckerberg talks about community, and he talks about it religiously now, and he made a joke yesterday about his huge essay in many pages. Community isn't just about replicating the communities we're already in. Community is about enabling us to find new people, and indeed, that's what happens. I was talking about this recently with Dave Weiner in Perugia, where I said, Dave, what happened to blogging in the early days of blogging? It was so wonderful. I met people from Iran and Iraq. I talked to conservatives for whom I now turn off the TV if I see them on there. We were able to have civil conversations. What was it? And Dave said, everything's nice in the beginning, Jeff.
That's
is that
really the bottom line. Everything's nice in the beginning. Yeah. Period.
Are we doomed to that? Or is Facebook just a small, nascent beginning of what it could be in a truly social platform where it does enable us to create new communities and even new societies? Do you think that big? I mean, to me, that's bigger thinking than drones and AR. Is rethinking the human connections. And I think that's what Facebook may be losing a little bit, and that's what its real focus should be.
Well, and I think Mark Zuckerberg talked about that. In the keynote, right? That's one of the things he said they are trying to do.
Yeah, that's his new manifesto, right? That's the community part of it.
Bring community together, break down walls.
Right. Stacey, you were starting to break in.
No, I was just going to say, doesn't Twitter perform that function for lots of people? I mean, I know I meet lots of people in different communities I've created on Twitter.
Yeah. So, me too.
Twitter
is also kind of a cesspool.
Yeah. Well, can you say you really have an interaction at 140 characters per? I mean, is
yes,
that
yes,
you can?
I have. Yeah,
I think
have
you can.
Yep. Met lots of the people that I communicate with on Twitter, and
me too.
I was definitely friends and knew them first.
I do actually remember in the early days of Twitter meeting people and thinking of them as their Twitter handle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know their name. I knew their Twitter handle.
I still do that.
Same in the early day of blogs. But here's the problem. I think Facebook could be falling into a media trap where what they see themselves doing is constantly creating new ways for people to create content. They're not content. They're people connecting with each other in communities. And if you truly imagine what that looks like, then you rethink the nature of communities and connections. So vegans from around the world could get together.
Right.
No, you can't, because that's highly engaged. It's just you think content is just a tool, not the end. I think Facebook, in its soul, knows that.
Yeah, I wonder whether, I mean, I think Mark Zuckerberg is sincere.
You're laughing, Stacey.
About what he wants to do. But I think it's going to be a whole lot harder than he thinks it is to actually
Stacey, do. Stacey, you laughed.
I was just laughing at your belief, your optimism here in this. And, sorry.
Oh, Jeff.
Stacey, you're so naive.
Jeff.
Stacey says, pah, to your optimism.
Ha. Kids nowadays.
I tell you. Jeff Jarvis is with us from, as you probably could tell from the sound quality, from the floor of F8. In San Jose. We're thrilled to have you. We can survive. Also with us, Matthew Ingram, who is visiting from Canada. He's at fortune.com. And Stacey Higginbotham from Austin, Texas, from IoTpodcast.com. Well, more in a minute. Obviously, as long as we've got Jeff here, we should keep talking about Facebook and F8, but we've got lots of other Google stuff to talk about, too. Our show today brought to you by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is awesome. LegalZoom is how we started Twit. 12 years, Monday was our 12th anniversary. I don't think I...
Mazel.
Yeah, isn't that great? 12 years?
You're
a year younger than Facebook.
Wow, you're almost a teenager.
I know. Pretty soon I'm going to break out.
Soon you'll be a man.
Soon I shall be a man and responsible for this thing. But it wasn't right away. I think it was within the first year or two I decided to create an LLC. I asked my friend Kevin Rose, who'd started many a company. He said, oh, yeah, go to LegalZoom, and you can do it all. It's cheap online. You don't need a lawyer. And we did. More than 1 million people have trusted LegalZoom to start their businesses. Incorporation, LLCs, nonprofits, DBAs, and more. You can use LegalZoom to get started right away. One of the five things business owners can count on from LegalZoom: reliability, experience. They've been doing this for 15 years. Plenty of experience in helping people with their legal needs. Great support. The right people standing by ready for your questions, all based in the U.S. And by the way, even though LegalZoom is not a law firm, you can get legal advice from LegalZoom because they have a network of independent attorneys who can do things like review contracts, help with employment law, advise you on, those hurdles that come up when you run a business. Finally, no surprises. LegalZoom provides complete transparency. You know up front what it's going to cost. You can see customer reviews right there on the site. There is a satisfaction guarantee. So for the paperwork you need, for the advice you need, for the support you need, LegalZoom is there to help you start your business, make your will, or do a whole variety of legal tasks. Check out LegalZoom today. See how they can make life better for you and your business. And don't forget to enter Twig when you check out to save. That's LegalZoom.com. The offer code TWIG. That lets them know you heard it here. We thank LegalZoom for many years, a sponsor, and pleased to say they've helped us. We did trademark through LegalZoom. We did the LLC through LegalZoom. They really are great. LegalZoom.com, offer code TWIG. Jeff Jarvis is in a break. Where are you going next?
Back to the media track. They have a separate... Last year, they had a room with about 120 seats. It was for just media people. But all the non-technical people who come to F8 kind of went there, so they couldn't even get the media people.
I can understand this new stuff. I don't understand the VR, but I understand the new stuff.
Yeah, new stuff. So this year they had a room that, I don't know, was 1,000 people, and that filled.
Wow.
And now there's a private track for media executives and such. They're really putting a big emphasis on news and media here.
Are they attempting to solve the instant articles problem, the exodus from instant articles?
Yes. They emphasize that in the beginning of every talk. They emphasize how they're trying to increase monetization to instant articles. Number one, new ad opportunity, more ads in it. You know, we'll see what works. New kind of ad units. We'll see where that goes. Second, they also recognize that a lot of publishers who have paywalls and pay meters really want to convert, and that they're working on that. The problem for some, like the New York Times, instant articles does not work well with a pay meter. Either it's available for Facebook or it's not. So they know they've got to work on that. They're working on that and trying to figure out a mechanism. AMP has worked on that separately. And I think that, yes, they're taking it seriously. There's some skepticism, to be true. And here's the problem I have with instant articles. The thing that I say about it is that the fundamental problem with instant articles is it plays to our worst egotistical notions that everything is an article. And it stops us from innovating in news in other ways, and stops Facebook from helping us monetize by using Facebook properly to bring journalism to the conversation. And so instant articles is great as far as it goes, but it's not the be-all and end-all, and I fear that media are going to expect it to be that.
I actually don't think, maybe I'm wrong, and Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like instant articles was something Facebook kind of cared about a year or two ago. I mean, so much has happened since then. Video is now the big deal. Facebook has its eye on lots of other balls. It doesn't feel like helping newspaper articles load faster on mobile.
They're investing in it. It matters to Facebook because they think it's a path to helping publishers monetize and sustain. So they think they've got to make it monetize equal to the web, basically, is what they say. And I think that's fine. I got no objection to that whatsoever. But again, I think that it's not the only path. And we in media tend too often to think there's a false messiah. Tablets will save us. Meters will save us. Native advertising will save us. Instant articles and AMP will save us. None of those will save us. They'll be a bit better, but we have to rethink journalism fundamentally, and that's what I really want Google and Facebook to do. And that's what I hope that the thing I'm working on, the News Integrity Initiative, can inspire some collaboration along those lines. Facebook is also caring about local. They recognize that instant articles does not serve local terribly well. It's more for national media. They don't have a plan for local yet. They're quick to say that, but they are thinking about how to start to think about that. So, no, I don't think instant articles is by any means, in their view, getting dust on the shelf. What I hope is that they learn to create more new things.
Ben Thompson, writing today in Stratechery, says quite an indictment. This is kind of harkening back to our earlier conversation that Facebook can steal from Snapchat and win because of their monopoly. And he does liken it, as we did, to Microsoft. And he says they should be worried because, remember, Microsoft faced some very vigorous antitrust action.
And I think Facebook is in Europe as well, maybe not in the U.S., but Europe is definitely thinking about it.
And just from a point of view of a consumer in a monopoly situation, he writes, there's no competition. The monopoly provider makes decisions based on profit maximization. So they don't have to worry about the demand curve. They just consider the marginal revenue is gained from selling additional items. They basically win by winning.
But look at the graph that he has for Facebook, because the marginal cost, that's the curve.
Marginal cost is effectively zero.
Is zero, mm-hmm. Right. So all they have to care about is demand.
Yeah.
Right.
The hard part, and the only thing I would say to Ben is, what does Facebook have a monopoly on? So does it have a large chunk of the ad market? Yes. Does it have a huge number of users? Yes. But if you were to go after it sort of from a legal point of view, what is the monopoly that Facebook has? What is it on?
It has a monopoly on access to data that is going to improve the way everything that we have is being delivered to us. So this is actually a really interesting Okay, so I read random papers, because academic papers. And I read one that talked about how we're going to look at monopolies in a digital world. And it's really smart. I'm looking for it right now so I can tell you. It's from Chetan Sharma. I don't know if you remember him, Matthew.
Yeah, I certainly do.
So he smart has guy. An entire paper called Competition, Rethinking the Regulatory Framework. And the whole idea, he looks at how we have failed.
So data is the market.
Yeah, to look at how connectivity, like our ownership of different levels of connectivity, and then how the influx of data that companies are gathering about people change the question of monopolies. Because with AI,
and I agree.
Yeah,
I think he's right. I mean, that definitely is the problem. Is you're going to have to rewrite competition policy. Is that going to happen?
Okay with that. Yes, maybe.
I know, but when
Europe's trying.
Yeah, no, they are. And I agree that that's the market that we should be looking at. It's not the market for likes or clicks, or it's the underlying data about us as individuals and our social graph. But how you define that in such a way that you can apply competition policy is a really big, that's just a really big question.
And we say this all the time, though, in tech. And I get very frustrated with us because we're like, wow, that's a big problem. And there's a lot of innovation coming out. Let's just step back for a while. And I think we need to start really talking about it, because tech is only going to become more essential and more entwined in our lives. And we can't afford to step back anymore.
And if Facebook continues to do all the things that they're describing, that monopoly, if they have one over those things, is going to become even more powerful. I mean, all you have to do is look at them providing internet access to underdeveloped countries. That effectively puts them in a position that, you know, that no other company has been in, I don't think. So how do you...
The interesting thing is, with our data, we don't actually have... It's not a monopoly in the sense that I can grant my access to my data to Facebook, to Google, right, to all of these other companies. So there are some kind of crazy fun legal things to think about.
There should be user control. I mean, you should be able to extract your data and export it wherever you want.
So Sir Jim Berners-Lee is arguing for just that. We've talked a long time about the vault and having your own data stored locally and you get permission to it. So Sir Tim is thinking about, have you talked about it on the show, Leo?
No.
No. Sir Tim's efforts to rethink the web around just what you guys are talking about is you have access, control of your data. Now, it's hard to imagine separating the data from the experience, separating the data from the transaction, separating the data from other people. Nonetheless, I do see if Sir Tim's working on it, I'm hoping that people will pay attention. We can start experimenting with this.
You know, tomorrow I have a guest on my show that actually is doing... Don't hate me, you guys. I'm going to say the magic B word. He's doing a blockchain-based way to track this. I don't know if his solution is the right one, but this is a way to deliver
that. I've heard some interesting stuff around that. Yeah, as a way of tracking. It's certainly a sort of low... I think it would be an efficient way of tracking things, whether it's information...
Incidentally, to get back to the instant articles, Ben also points out that instant articles problem is because Facebook's a monopoly. He said, yeah, they monetized, but they weren't incented in any way to really share it with the publishers. They kept...
Oh, come on. They give publishers 100% of the revenue that the publishers sell and 70% of the revenue that Facebook sells.
Well, apparently it's not enough for the publishers, right?
Well, okay, but hello. The job here is not to replace what the publishers used to have when they had monopolies.
Well, and Ben's point is, it doesn't matter whether the publishers are happy or unhappy, because Facebook has a monopoly.
Because Facebook doesn't care.
It doesn't care. Right. Facebook is so dominant, he writes, when it comes to attention, that it doesn't have to do anything for publishers at all. And if said publishers leave instant articles, well, they'll still place links and the users aren't going anywhere regardless.
But they are.
And I have to say, I don't want to say anything. I know, Jeff, you know, the News Integrity Project is a great idea. I hope Facebook is working on all kinds of things to help journalism and so on. But I wonder if for all the things they say about it, media, journalism, whatever you want to call it, is a tiny fraction of what happens on the platform. It's never going to be the thing that they care about the most, because it doesn't generate a lot of revenue. And it just isn't a huge part of what people do. Well, they come in contact with news accidentally while they're doing other things.
It's not core to what Facebook really is, and Facebook says that. And that's fine. It's not. Nobody says that it should be. Their number one job is to connect you with your friends and family. Now they add to this, Zuckerberg adds to this and says, well, we're going to move past that to also connect you to your communities and to larger communities. That's job number one. Job number they don't put it in this list, but I will, is to entertain you, to amuse you, to engage you. Job number three, almost coincidentally, is to inform you. Because that's what it does do. They recognize that. They didn't build it for that. It does that job fine, and they'll improve how it does that job. But no one at Facebook would ever say that's job one. No one.
Ben concludes that the real problem with monopolies basically just don't innovate. It's hard to think, he writes, of any example where established monopolies produce technology that wouldn't have been produced by the free market. That's why Facebook's theft of not just Snapchat's features, but its entire vision bums me out, even if it makes good business sense.
Which is a point.
I'm a little more optimistic about Snapchat's potential to survive than Ben is in that piece. I don't think Snapchat actually is competing against Facebook in any kind of fundamental way. Snapchat is doing something completely different. Snapchat is all about private communication. Facebook is all about public. They're two very different things. Everyone I know who uses Snapchat has no interest in sharing things publicly, no interest in how many followers or likes they have, no interest in it's all about one-to-one or one-to-a-small group.
It's funny, too, because when I use Snapchat, I have a different bent, I'm not young, I'm always thinking, how can I get this great picture out and put it on Instagram
or Facebook?
But you're right. My kid doesn't use it that way. No, my 22-year-old doesn't use it that way.
Exactly.
It's only the older people, the adults, that you see their Snapchat filters. You don't see
any kids. And they're the ones moving to Instagram, right? They're the ones saying Instagram's better because I can see how many people read it or saw it or watched it. Snapchat,
Evan Spiegel,
that is not what Snapchat's about.
If you're
about.
Evan Spiegel at Snapchat, do you just sit back complacently and say, well, let Facebook have these old farts. I've got the future. I've got the kids.
This is what I was talking about. It's a new way to use a network. And it's how Facebook gets replaced.
There was a good piece. Mashable had a great piece. I forget who wrote it now, but looking at Facebook's going to kill Snapchat or Instagram is going to kill Snapchat because it's copied everything. The two are fundamentally different. And so I don't see people who are hardcore Snapchat users suddenly deciding, I guess I'll just use Instagram instead. They operate in fundamentally different ways.
No, I asked those kids, these Australian teenagers, they all still were on Snapchat. They hadn't moved to Instagram. So, Stacey, you think for your daughter and her generation that Facebook isn't going to be the monopoly it is today, that Snapchat will, or somebody like it, will supersede them?
You'll just have a different interface paradigm with your friends. Okay, I cannot believe I just said that. Those words those weren't even real words.
This is how those words happen. They just come out.
That's what your daughter talks to.
But that makes sense.
Interface paradigm for your friends. Let's just swallow that.
That's
for
the
a
new. That's the new tagline.
Excuse me. You're my new friend, but I still have yet to decide on our interface paradigm. Maybe we'll do a VR thing for just to try. See, I think you're right. But I think what it is she'll use both, though, right? She'll have a public Facebook and a private. Maybe not.
To be honest, I think Mark Zuckerberg is terrified. Like I know that
if you steal from somebody, as they did with Instagram, and they're doing that with Facebook, it's because you see them as a threat. And very famously, he tried very hard to buy Snapchat. He was able to buy WhatsApp and Instagram previous threats to Facebook's dominance. He was not able to buy
Snapchat. I think when he lies awake at night, he is afraid of what Snapchat represents. Maybe not Snapchat specifically, but the change that Stacey's talking about, those changes in the way people behave and the way they interact and whether Facebook is going to miss the boat.
Well, they can't really change their public is kind of fundamental to Facebook, right? You can't really...
Exactly. So, and I wonder whether, if you look at Instagram or WhatsApp or everything Facebook tries in a way is a way of kind of reinventing Facebook itself while still keeping the original Facebook.
Which was Farhad's point. The power is
trying to think of a future. What is the future?
But doesn't the power of the network ultimately depend on keeping those people? And haven't we seen in the past how the power of the network can just evaporate like mists?
It can, but they also said yesterday that they are. I'm sorry. There's a stairwell here that goes nowhere. I see people going.
They should put a.
That's
sign
a metaphor.
Up.
There's a metaphor.
Yeah,
there.
Maybe that's the Facebook stairwell. Oh, and we lost him.
We lost him.
Let's take a break while we try to get him back. I think we're almost done with our conversation about F8. I'll give you all three of you a chance to say some final words, and then we'll talk about some other news of the week on This Week in Google. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Quicken Loans, one of the best, most innovative, most interesting companies, home mortgage lenders in the nation. I mean, just not only are they, I think, number two in the business, they're doing some of the most interesting things, and they're very trustworthy. They're beloved. If you look at the website, you'll see all those J.D. Power Customer Satisfaction Awards. Number one year after year for financial services for mortgage origination and for mortgage servicing. And they know that there are people like us who want to apply for our home loan or our refinance entirely online. So they created a product just for us called Rocket Mortgage. It lifts the burden of getting a home loan. You got to work with someone you trust. Someone's got your best interest in mind. But if you're going to do that, do it with Quicken Loans and make it easy on yourself with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is a mortgage approval process you could do from your phone, your tablet. You could do it anywhere you are. You could do it in an open house. You could see a house and say, I like this house. Let's buy this house. Let's apply for the loan. You have, because it's all online, you submit everything online, including whatever paperwork they need, pay stubs and bank statements typically. They allow you to, you know, play with a slider for, you know, to see what your payments would be depending on the rate and the term of the loan and get it just right and then push the button and apply. And now I think back to the last time we bought a house, it took me more than a month. Lisa and I took a month to get our home loan, and they kept coming back to us for more stuff. With Rocket Mortgage, it's minutes, not months, minutes to approval. You could literally do it, as I said, at the open house and show the realtor. It says, look, it says we're approved. We'd like to buy this house. Whether you're looking to buy or refi, lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. Go completely online. QuickenLoans.com/twig. QuickenLoans.com/twig. Let me see if I can do the legalese. Normally, I would do it really fast. You know, that's what they do on radio. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. But you can't hear it. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030. That's Rocket Mortgage. Go to quickenloans.com/twig. Stacy, we've all decided that the name of the show will be A New Interface Paradigm for Your Friends.
Oh. Stacy, this is why I'm better in writing, because I can look at things like that and go, oh, God, what was I thinking?
Oh, man, I'd look at it and go, yeah, good sentence, Leo. Stacy Higginbotham's here. Jeff Jarvis is here. Matthew Ingram's here. I'm surrounded by journalists. I feel out of place. Jeff is...
You sound horrified.
I'm terrified that you'll catch me out.
Go.
Are you going to take off?
I'm going to take off the bandwidth this bad, but thank you for suffering my sound and everything else.
No
I'll
problem.
See you, Stacey.
Any final thoughts as you go back to F8? Anything you want to say?
No, the bar opens in 2 hours.
That's all I need to know. Thank you, Jeff Jarvis. Right. BuzzMachine.com. He's going back to the media room where they're talking about...
say hi to Mark.
Say hi to Mark. Talking about news.
Yes, about you.
So how's that Matthew doing? Matthew with one T. I always liked him.
Yeah, I like that guy.
I always liked that guy.
See you, Jeff. Of his jib.
Actually, I don't know if there's a coincidence or if it's real, but didn't Google had a social network called Spaces, which they announced in February they were going to kill, and they killed it on Friday. And then on Monday or Tuesday,
Facebook
announces its own Spaces. Do you think they had a deal?
And it's Easter. Is there a coincidence?
Ah.
Maybe Facebook Plus is coming.
If Tom announces my Spaces, then we'll know. Yeah, Facebook Plus, that would be funny.
All right, I'll see you guys.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Bye, Jeff.
Actually, it said that Facebook responded to Google Plus with a batten down the hatches, all hands on deck, kind of close, lock the doors.
Oh,
we're gonna respond.
They did, yeah.
Yeah, it said they did the same exact thing with Snapchat, and you know, how are we going to respond to this?
Yeah, it was like a 3-month, yeah, you know, 24-hour lockdown.
Yeah.
As it turned out, Google Plus was nothing
to worry about.
Big competitor.
Yeah, I think those people who were locked in there for 3 months felt when they found that out.
Yeah.
Maybe they declared victory. They said, see, what we did worked.
I was going to say, maybe they only stayed there for, 1.5 months. Yeah. Like, oh, you know what, guys? Y'all can come out now.
Not a big deal. No big deal. All right. Let's see. I'm trying to, but there's so much Facebook material. I think we covered a good set of it.
I feel like we got a lot. Matthew, you have, because Matthew's the Facebook guy, so.
Yeah, well, I did say I'd let you guys offer a final coda on what we saw in the last 2 days.
I have my new interface paradigm. Apparently, that was my one. That was my addition to this combo.
I have to say, I think I always enjoy seeing what a company operating at this kind of scale, it can do in the way of being nimble. And yeah, you could say they copied, but I agree with Farhad. You know, everybody, all great artists steal, as Steve Jobs famously said, that this is, you know, everybody stands on everybody else's shoulders. And I like seeing the kinds of innovations that Facebook's doing. I think that this is encouraging for a monopoly. On the other hand, I do feel like their dominance is threatening. It's threatening to the internet, mm-hmm, to the open web that we know, to media consumption. Because whether they admit it or not, they're clearly a media company, and that's always a worry.
That's definitely my, you know, I enjoy the Gee Whiz stuff, and I enjoy the sort of thinking about the future of interface paradigms and whatnot. But I mean, I'm fundamentally a media guy, and I've been arguing, banging the drum for years that Facebook is a media company, the biggest and most powerful media company that has ever existed in human history.
They still do not admit that, do they? I mean,
Mark Zuckerberg's kind of tiptoed around, you know, we're not really a media company, but we're kind of involved in it. So at least he's, you know, they were there in Perugia at the journalism festival, which they had not been. You know, they threw a party. They talked about the news integrity initiative. They're setting up things like the journalism project. So at least they're trying to do things. But I'm still concerned about the fundamentals of the kind of control that they have over the information that people consume, and that power is really frightening in a lot of ways. If you look at the fake news issue, they came out with some tips about how to make sure that the news you're consuming is not fake. And one of the things they mentioned was you should look at the URL.
The first thing I thought of was
Facebook has spent years basically hiding and obscuring the URL as much as possible so that you will not click on it, because that would take you outside of the network. So that they're fundamentally trying to suck and blow at the same time. You know, you can't say check the URL, but we're going to move it around and you won't be able to find it. So fundamentally, some of the things they've done to keep people in the platform and to boost engagement are the same things that they're now saying they're going to fight. So I wonder about that.
Yeah, Mike Caulfield wrote a very good piece on Medium. He is actually part of a web literacy program at WSU Vancouver.
Yeah, it was a great piece.
Facebook's news literacy advice is harmful to news literacy. He says, we've been working in this space for a long time. We know what works and doesn't. He says, most of what Facebook's media literacy campaign contained was bad advice. He lists the various things and says exactly what you said, which is, you know, A, there's no evidence that any of this works. And B, it's, you know, they actually make it harder to do.
Yeah.
He says, you know, this process, you know, is fine to recommend it, but nobody's going to do it because it takes too long.
So what they suggested was basically what they did was effectively the least possible
right
thing they could do.
Well, it was almost trite. It was almost like the obvious. You know,
not almost. I think it was.
It was the kind of thing I've been saying for years. You know, we need critical thinking, and you got to check the URL.
Think more critically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, problem solved. The reality is, if you remember, there was an interview with a Facebook newsfeed staffer, former Facebook newsfeed staffer, who said, all Facebook cares about is engagement. And you know what's engaging? Bullshit.
Right.
So
fake news works for Facebook's business.
Exactly. The structure of that machine depends on things that make you engaged, not on things that are true.
And that's really why they had this problem, because their algorithm favored it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because people engage with it.
Yeah.
The faker it is, the more people will engage with it.
Right. And that, I think that's why Mark, I'm glad to hear he's coming around a little bit, but was reluctant to say they're a media company, because really their business model is at odds with
being a
responsible media company. Right.
And unfortunately, his manifesto, if he wants to follow through on lots of the things that he said in there, it's going to sort of run headlong into the things that Facebook is already doing because of its business. You know, you can't. So some of that is either going to have to change, or he won't be able to follow through on the type of stuff that he's talking about bringing people together and helping people with their, you know, community information needs and stuff like that. That's just not the kind of machine that he has built.
What does Chernet say about digital monopoly? Because it does strike me that, Microsoft was a monopoly, and perhaps the Department of Justice brought it down, or the EU actions brought it down, but more likely just the nature of the world, the nature of the digital economy brought it down, the business cycle.
Time moving
down.
On.
Time moved on.
Right.
Is that
so? The most persuasive theory I've heard from someone who followed the antitrust case was that the case slowed Microsoft down.
Yeah.
So it didn't really fundamentally change much, but it sort of slowed it down, and that made it easier for other things to come along and disrupt Microsoft.
I don't know. Like the Germans having to fight Russia and Europe at the same time.
It's a two-front war.
It just slows you down. And so, but for there's no question in my mind that innovation and new developments would inevitably have done the same thing. So maybe the case just kind of sped that process up.
Well, and the reason I bring it up is maybe we don't have to worry.
As a government, you can't say...
Well,
this will solve itself over time.
Well, I don't know what the government is.
Well,
going to.
I'm just saying, if you're a regulator looking at this,
well, and they're not going to do anything.
Yeah,
right? Certainly not the current government is not going to wade into Facebook and its monopoly on. Like, that's just never going to happen. I still think we need to worry, and I still think we need to point these kinds of things out and put some pressure on. It feels to me like Mark Zuckerberg is genuinely concerned about some of this stuff, or at least he does a good job of pretending to be concerned. So maybe we should, you know, build on that if we can. I don't think he's a bad person. He's not doing, you know, wrong things deliberately because he wants to kill the media or, you know, make people share fake news articles. It's just a function of how Facebook operates.
What is that paper you read? What was it? Chernet?
Chet and Sharma.
What does Chet and Sharma say about this?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me. Well, no, I didn't think you were going to ask me. I went away from it and didn't see it again.
Well, we have his website, but I also have an article. I think he wrote in The Economist a few years ago, trust busting in the digital age. Mm. And he says there are good reasons why governments should regulate internet monopolies less energetic than offline ones. The barriers to entry are lower in the digital realm, so there's more competition. But he also, and I think this is him, says, finally, the lesson of recent decades is technology monopolists may be dominant for a while, but they are eventually toppled when they fail to move within the times or when new technology expand the market in unexpected ways.
And definitely research shows that. I mean, all the research I've read shows innovation and certainly internet-powered digital innovation happens much faster. By the time the government takes action, it's too late anyway, usually.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the DOJ case, which began in 1998 and concluded some 4 years later. And I think by the time it concluded, you know, the whole issue was, you know, including the browser and the operating system. The whole question was moot.
Yeah.
So
the risk is, and I know Tim Wu has talked about this and written about this, the network effects of the kind that Facebook has, particularly over information and connections, the social graph or whatever, is something unlike anything we've seen. So Microsoft's control over your operating system wasn't anything like what we're talking about. And it's a monopoly that feeds on itself in a way that requires no effort on Facebook's part, because we do it, users do it. And that creates such a huge barrier, and yet it's a barrier that is almost impossible to dismantle, because Facebook didn't create it. Users created it.
You may remember, changing the subject a little bit, 3 years ago, the Wall Street Journal reported the FBI was considering loosening its restrictions on marijuana. James Comey implying he was having a hard time finding hackers who hadn't smoked weed. Well, Motherboard reports this week, the FBI says it can finally find hackers who don't smoke weed. So it still has a ban on hiring anyone who's used marijuana.
How did it do that, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't know. And how good are these hackers, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I was wondering about, like, what kind of lame drug tests are they using now?
Or maybe they're not smoking weed. They're using other drugs. I don't know. Or maybe they're... Is it okay if I microdose LSD?
Oh, that's trendy.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's totally
that's okay.
Fine. Yeah.
Since they don't have a test for that anyway, yeah, that's fine.
But weed is right out.
I loved the Jim Sensenbrenner, who is a Republican member of Congress from, I think it was Ohio. Remember talking about this net neutrality, he's from Wisconsin, the internet privacy rules. He was talking meeting of his town hall meeting of his constituents, and they pointed out, you know, they were upset that he voted to roll back FCC privacy, and they pointed out, you know, he said, well, it's like Google or Facebook, you know, we want a level playing field, which is what the Republican response has been. You know,
you don't have to use the internet.
That was his answer.
Yeah.
One of his constituents said, well, you don't have to use Google or Facebook, and Sensenbrenner says, yeah, well, you don't have to use the internet.
Fair enough.
He says, if you start regulating the internet like a utility, if you did that right at the beginning, we would have no internet. I don't know if that's true. I don't think it's my job to tell you cannot get advertising for your information being sold. My job is to tell you that you have the opportunity to do it. And then you take it upon yourself to make the choice that government should give you. Facebook, a woman said, is not comparable to an ISP. I do not have to go on Facebook. I do have one provider. I live 2 miles from here. I have one choice. I don't have to go on Google. But my internet service provider is different.
That's what his whole argument, that in fact, the whole conservative argument about it's just that it fails because they're comparing Google and Facebook, you know, using your
completely different
information for ads.
Well, yeah.
You have one choice.
You're right. This was the line the ISPs fed them. Mm-hmm. This was in all the briefings. But really, can we raise the bar, not lower the bar? I don't mind a level playing field. Let's raise the bar.
They're not similar. My choice to use Google or Facebook is not the same as my choice to use the single ISP, you know, that I can get access from. That's not comparable.
Android's head of security says...
I have a Google-related story.
A Google-related story.
That I didn't see on the rundown.
Bring it up.
Okay. Google yesterday made their Cloud Speech API available, and you guys may be like, bleh. But this is basically Google's version of Amazon Echo's voice services.
Yeah,
so this is actually a big deal, because when I talked to developers probably 8 or 9 months ago, they're like, Google has great stuff, but you have to like beat them over the head and beg them to get access to it. It's completely opposite of the way Amazon treated AVS. So
there
now,
you go, competition.
There you go.
It's a good thing.
Good point. So you can, And by the way, this is a business for them. They're not giving this away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You know, but so great. You know, so speech recognition, convert audio to text by applying their neural network models, an easy to use API that recognizes 80 languages. Wow.
Oof.
Wow.
Mm. I like the inappropriate content filtering in text results for some languages. I thought, I don't know if the Echo or AVS has that.
Wait a minute. It has a button on here. Start now. What happens? Hello, my name is Leo, and I am a technology show host. I don't think it's hearing me. Anyway, you can do this for yourself and return text results in real time. So it's basically okay, you know who, but that anybody can use. I like that.
Yeah, it's the back end for Google Assistant, I believe.
It handles noisy audio from any environments. So it does the recognition, but it doesn't do the artificial intelligence understanding part. It just sends you back text.
Right. It's speech recognition, and then it doesn't type back? Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know why they put this on a page, because you could do this on your phone. It's exactly the same thing. It's doing the recognition in real time as it's talking, and it isn't doing a very good job, as a matter of fact.
I love it. Go on, Matthew.
I'm super excited about the sort of future of, you know, universal translation. Like, I don't care if it's
Amazon or Google or Microsoft.
I haven't just spent a bunch of time in Italy. Yeah, I'm looking forward to being able to say something and have, you know, it instantly translated into something.
That's what your another feature of your augmented reality glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
No,
because you have to look at your phone and talk into it, and then it talks.
Think that augmented reality earpieces will go along with those glasses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or Apple's AirPod type.
Yep.
You'll have some sort of thing in your ear.
Yep. A Babel.
Well, and I forget who wrote it, but somebody wrote a fascinating kind of near future potential for the wireless headphones like the AirPods as a control mechanism for all sorts of things, you know, just as something you keep in your ear and it understands you.
I wrote that once upon a time. It probably wasn't
Maybe
my
it was
version,
you.
Though. No, Maybe a lot of people you. Have written this, but I know I have too.
But I think that's a really compelling, you know, if speech becomes one of the primary ways that you interact, you're going to have something like that. You're not going to want to hold your phone in front of you all the time.
So, yes. And I will say, for all the people who are sad, because universal translation means that your languages you've learned are rendered useless, because that's my daughter is in a school right now that is teaching her two languages. Mm. So wow. I'm like, oh, I'm paying a lot for that. I hope
Spanish?
It works. And Mandarin.
Wow.
Because I'm a type A.
Is she not getting confused by learning two different languages at the same time?
She actually dreams in Spanish, so she's been learning Spanish. It's an immersion school since kindergarten.
Okay, so she's now really bilingual.
And research shows that kids their brains are a lot more flexible than old people.
Yeah.
Like they're capable of learning multiple things, and the more languages you learn, the easier it gets.
Yeah, but simultaneous is tough.
Yeah,
I think. I mean, I seem
especially
to remember,
Mandarin.
Yeah,
Mandarin's one of the hardest languages.
I was
to learn.
That was my major in college. It is
wow.
It's actually surprisingly easy to learn the spoken Mandarin if you can handle the tone structure.
Tonal shift, yeah.
The pronunciation's hard, but the language itself is one of the simplest languages because it's old. The older the language, the less you don't have declinations, conjugations. You don't even have past and future.
That's true. But the thing that's hard for people to learn is the tonal shift.
Yeah, but that's like singing, and I bet your daughter's good at it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know... You know, it's not, it's, you just learn each, you know.
Up and down. Yeah.
You know, there's war. There's just different tones. Once you learn that, it's not that complicated.
I'm tone deaf. I have a hard time.
Well, we need to go for dim sum sometime.
The hard thing is the written language, which is
probably. It is beautiful and complicated, and I feel
it's
sad for
calligraphy.
Her.
It's something completely different. And they can't, you're not, when you're writing, drawing a character, for instance, there's an order to each stroke. Mm-hmm. You can't make up, you can't say, well, I'll do this later. You got to do it in exactly the right order. And they can tell if you don't do it right. And those Chinese teachers are mean.
They put the fear of God into my child. She is.
They take it seriously.
Sad. You need to teach her Heptapod.
What's that?
From the movie Arrival.
Oh yes.
Did you see
that?
It
was an interesting language because it looked like Rorschach. Yeah. Ink blots.
My daughter took linguistics, and she was fascinated by the way they constructed that language.
Because it's real, right? I mean, it's not a real language, but they attempted to follow linguistic rules and
right.
grammar.
But they thought it through. How would you have a language where the whole thing is a sentence? It's not structured in parts in the same way that our languages are.
Yeah,
it's and like it German times backwards a
million and forwards.
Well, yeah. Chinese is like that, where one character is you know many.
Is a thought.
Is exactly. a thought. And this is, Heptapod is,
Yeah, it was fascinating. They did a really good job.
I don't think it's a spoiler anymore, right? We can talk about it. I hope.
I've never seen it.
I'm okay.
I'm not going to hold you to it. I'm just like, it's fascinating. Seen it, sorry.
It's the not really a sci-fi. It's not really a sci-fi movie. I mean, there's aliens, but, it's
really well done.
Yeah. I thought it was very good.
I will check it out. I just haven't gotten to
it. Reminds me, it's more like Inception in that sense. It's more like...
I hate that movie.
No, it's not.
I
not
hate
weird.
Movies who are like, I'm going to mess with you.
Yes.
A lot.
Okay, it's well, a prepare, little like there is a little of that. Like, yes, there is.
But the language is very well done.
I think, you know what? I'm going to predict you will like it, Stacey.
Me okay. too.
I am. I'm going to predict you will like it. It's,
I will endeavor to watch it.
Now, Matthew knows you much better.
The star
than
is
I
a nerd.
Do.
A nerd lady, so
yeah, it's nerdy and it's intellectually interesting, and I think it will.
Yeah, it's really well done.
Yeah, Heptapod. Okay. If a JIT Pi moves too fast, this is a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. If the chairman moves too fast, he risks a court fight in attempting to kill things like net neutrality. But if he goes too slow, it gives the opponents time to organize a SOPA-like protest, and you know how that ended. So kind of a challenge, apparently, politically, to kill net neutrality. I'm glad to hear it, anyway.
You want the death of net neutrality?
No, I'm glad to hear it's a challenge.
Oh,
that
yes.
whole thing is just a minefield. Like, the whole
Why?
Thing is just...
That's Why exactly their there? Words. Whatever path Mr. Pai chooses, his road is studded with possible landmines, including vacancies on his commission, a continuing court fight over current rules, a new Supreme Court justice, the coming 2018 midterm elections, and the potential for the kind of widespread protest only internet activists can organize. I do believe that Congress is a little bit, as post-SOPA, they've, you know, and of course the net neutrality laws or regulations were instituted after an extensive comment period where they received more comments than they'd ever received on anything since
Net
Janet
neutrality
Jackson.
Has been going on since
since the internet was
since
invented.
2000. So 2005 is when we first started fighting over it. But
and remember, I think we convinced Tom Wheeler to kind of change his tune, and it was the millions of comments.
He was not going to do Title II.
Right.
That was like the third rail of this policy. And then he was like, okay, I guess this is how we're doing it.
We have to. Well, he didn't really have any other way to do it. Right? He had to do it.
The court told him he had to go with Title II.
In order to achieve what he wanted to achieve, he had to do that.
And, you know, this actually is a larger and really, I'm going to be fair, a much more complex discussion, which is that the FCC can only do what the Congress mandates it to do. And there are those in Congress who feel like, you know, whatever Jim Sensenbrenner says, that choosing to regulate internet service providers like normal utilities, in other words, invoking Title II of the Telecommunications Act, wasn't Congress's intent. So that while it was available as an option, many in Congress thought, this is not what we meant when we wrote the Telecommunications
Right.
Act. And this is a willful misinterpretation of this to get a certain... And what really should happen, and I may
it's
have
a
to
rewrite
give,
of the telecommunications.
Exactly.
Act.
I may have to give Ajit Pai credit. He may be saying, I think he is saying, this Title II really wasn't what the people who wrote the law envisioned. We should go back to Congress and have a comprehensive telecommunications act that addresses all of this.
And if we do that, that's fine. But just leave what we have. Don't don't go back
right.
and take the vase that was smashed on the floor and we tried to tape it all together and then it got smashed again and we taped it again. Don't go back to that. Say, okay, let's go out and make a new vase. And that's a terrible metaphor. But
there is some, you know, there is some evidence, as the journal points out, that just the new Justice Neil Gorsuch is really a strong believer that federal agencies should have much more constrained rulemaking capabilities, that Congress is ultimately responsible for this, and that Congress should tell the agencies what the rules are, not that the agencies should make up the rules.
And I think if they're one of the strongest parts of Ajit Pai's argument is that. So,
but the risk, and this is part of the risk, is we've got midterm elections coming up not so far right. off. And, mm-hmm. and the complexion of Congress could change. If you could get it to Congress now, you know, before the midterm elections, well, you'd be assured that you're going to get some rules that yeah. that are you know, favor big business.
You're not going to rewrite. Ajit Pai is, you're not going to be able to rewrite the Telecommunications Act
in a year.
I mean, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And if what Ajit Pai is saying is, well, let's just turn it back to the FTC and we'll just let them handle it, that's not really a solution.
I disagree. Yeah, and that he has said that as well, that this is not something the FCC should be involved in. The Federal Trade Commission should be involved in this. But that may be a disingenuous point of view, because the FTC, even though the FCC doesn't have an enforcement arm, the FTC does, they also have a lot more cases, including whether, you know, diapers give babies rashes and all sorts
FCC
of things.
The FCC has an enforcement arm. They have an enforcement bureau. They march down and find people all the time.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Did you not see that Christian like Slater movie?
There's like four vans in the whole country. And I don't think there's an FCC police.
There's one guy in each van.
It's the FCC Bureau of Enforcement.
No, I understand.
I used to know the head of it.
I understand. But I don't think it's really more about choppers? Making sure radio stations don't exceed their...
No. They find people. They find AT&T. They find people for cramming. They do a lot. I mean, and they also come down hard on the people who run cell phone jammers in movie theaters.
No, I agree with you. I think they would do a better job on this than the FTC, which has way too much on its plate.
Well, this is hard. And, you know, say what we will about Tom Wheeler. He listened very closely and had a deep technical understanding of what he was doing.
Yeah.
Ajit Pai, I swear to God, is like, he parrots the ISP line in a way that makes regulatory capture look too nice of a word.
I think we as geeks agree that the internet, we don't agree on is what the government's role in the internet should be, but that we would like an internet that is free and open to all. And certainly I made my living competing.
ISPs are not the internet, so we should talk about regulating ISPs as a monopoly player. And this is, you're falling into the trap that, sorry, Leo, I get so passionate about this.
Good.
ISPs want you to think that they are the internet. They are your access to the internet, which is why they should be under common carrier with forbearance, which is what the FCC tried to do. And that is all. That is it.
Yeah. Sorry. No. But I don't disagree with you. And then we did win that fight briefly. But I think that it's not completely unreasonable to say, well, we need to go back to Congress and get a real authorization for this, if that's what we want to do.
That would be the best.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know what would be the best? Would be no government interference, but just a really good competitive market where you could choose as a user, you'd have more than one or two choices.
Right. Which we don't have.
You don't have it in Canada. We don't have it in the U.S.
Right. And there's no sign of it coming anytime soon.
Well, no, it's quite the opposite, isn't it?
Right. Google gave up. You know,
it's getting worse.
Like Amsterdam has such a great, I wish we hadn't punted on 21st century infrastructure, because like, if you look at Amsterdam, what they've done is they laid conduit and they said, everyone has access to this conduit. Just run your pipes through it.
But also Amsterdam is the size of, you know, downtown
it's
Brooklyn.
It's clearly the right way to, I mean, not clearly, but I agree with you. It is my opinion, the right way to do this. Is to have the governments which have the right of way and put in the infrastructure and then let
But even Google didn't want to do open access when they talked about it initially, and then
that's
were like,
"There's such an outlay to put this in. That's why it has to be government. It has to be public.
This is what government does. Because I mean, the economic benefits of having fast internet access.
Remember, we have an administration that wants the highway system to be privatized.
Right. There is a role for government, and
I completely
agree. Frustrated.
And there, I think even a conservative, and in some respects, I'm a conservative, understands that the government represents society's interests, and sometimes society's interests run counter to the interests of businesses. That's in cases of monopoly, for instance. Monopolies are great for business, not so good for society, and that's an appropriate place for government to weigh in. And I think that it's appropriate for government to build infrastructure that includes roads, and I think you could argue
electricity,
and I think you could argue reasonably internet access. And what's great is there's a way to make this viable for government and for private industry. Have the government build the lines and then lease it to private industry, thereby defraying the cost so the taxpayers don't have to pay for it in the long run. And having some real competition on top of those lines.
And yet, even when municipalities and regions have tried to do that, they've been fought by ISPs and carriers.
Mostly, now I am going to get political here. In my opinion, that's because we have the best Congress money can buy.
That's not political.
that's just reality.
That's just a statement of fact.
And so money wins, and they're paying more money for your member of Congress's campaign than you are, and so they get to do what they want. And that's just really a shame. I mean, it all comes down to Larry Lessig has always said this. It all comes down to campaign finance reform. Until you get big money out of politics, you're never going to the people are never going to win.
Unfortunately, I think Larry just exchanged one unsolvable problem for an even larger unsolvable problem. Yeah.
Well, but he was right, though. That's the root.
He's right. He's totally.
If you don't solve that, you can do anything you want about DRM and IP and all of that, because it doesn't matter.
And all we have to do to change it is to fundamentally change human nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm on it.
Can you work on that? I think we need a new paradigm for new interface paradigm for human nature.
Interface.
Get on that, Stacey.
Interaction. Done.
The Galaxy S8 is emerging. This is, in my opinion, it's going to come out this week. We're already seeing reviews from all the big tech blogs. We've had it for a couple of weeks embargoed. In my opinion, this is going to change what we expect a smartphone to look like. Bezel-less is the future. And I'm sad to say... Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. Bezel-less OLEDs. And Apple's going to do it. Samsung's going to do it. And while I love this Pixel, it's going to start looking like a 1950 Ford Fairlane.
It's a classic car, man.
It's a classic.
Yeah, a classic car. Come on. Those things are worth a lot of money.
It's a classic, but what?
Bezel-less.
Maybe it's going to look more like a 1980s Volvo.
No, you don't. This has all been solved. Yeah, it's all been solved. And what you really want is just a big-ass screen with controls on the screen. I had to come around. I did not like it when Android started using on-screen buttons instead of physical buttons. But this is Samsung's abandoning it.
No, I'm fine with on-screen buttons.
Supposedly, Apple's abandoning it. They're going OLED, curved displays, infinity displays with the smallest possible bezel. And people are raving about this phone.
I thought I heard that
the camera is terrible, is it not?
No, the camera's the same as last year, which was superb.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I thought it wasn't that good.
Well, what I've seen. I'm getting mine on Friday, I'll let you know. But it's the same, as far as I can tell, it's a new Sony sensor, but very similar to last year's sensor, which was the S7 was very, very good.
Before it exploded?
And this one doesn't blow up. You see the problem.
You're right.
This phone is not going to explode, right?
This phone, well, I think you could make the argument that this is the phone least likely to explode.
Okay.
Right? After Samsung spent more than $3 billion on the Note 7 debacle, they announced, we're going to X-ray every phone. We've got all these new technologies. They're putting smaller batteries in these things. I think that they're probably going to, I would guess, going to bend over backwards to make sure this phone does not explode.
So smaller batteries, isn't that going to be bad?
3,000 milliamp hours in the 8, 3,500 milliamp hours in the S+. Android's doing a lot these days to make these phones last longer. I'm very curious. So far, battery tests look pretty good. It's up at the top, which isn't saying much because almost all phones' batteries are not enough. The biggest problem Samsung's going to have is Bixby, the highly touted voice assistant that for some reason Samsung felt like, oh, it needs another one. Unfortunately, when it ships, it is not shipping with Bixby. It's not ready for prime time. There is a physical Bixby button, and one would hope that you could map that to Google Assistant. In fact, early reports were that you could map it using software that lets you change keystroke actions. But we're now hearing stories that you can't. I, again, will let you know. This is something I'm going to want to do. Because if you've got a dedicated voice button, it's nice, right? That's a nice idea.
Yeah. Or if it works. It's like the tap.
Yeah. But if Samsung prevents you from doing it, even though Bixby's not ready, that would be really, really annoying.
That seems mean.
That would really be annoying. According to a post at XDA Developers, the new Galaxy S8 firmware update that you'll get when you get your new phone shuts down the ability to remap the Bixby button. The trick was accessibility could intercept it. You could map it and you could have it do something else, like make it maybe launch the camera or the calendar or, you know, Google's assistant.
Well, why have soft buttons if you can't program them?
Yeah, I agree.
I
agree.
See, I think they're afraid that no one will change it back.
That's exactly right.
Well, yes.
That's exactly right. Once you don't use Bixby, you'll never use Bixby.
Right.
And that makes sense. That's why you got to launch these things with the features intact.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
if only it was that simple.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody wants to. I'm sure they didn't think of it. Hey, this is really good news. Amazon has announced that they're going to, you know, the Amazon Echo has a very sophisticated 7-mic array.
We talked about this on the podcast this morning.
They're now making that available to third-party device makers.
Yep. So this leads to the big obvious question, which is, okay, everyone can build their own Amazon Echo.
Right.
This is great because if voice is the next UI, Amazon is going to be they have built the vocabulary that right now is positioned to be everywhere. So it's the pinch to zoom for voice, right? They've built that. Mm. And you can put it anywhere and everyone can have it. But how many devices do you want to talk to individually versus having one device be the butler for all of your devices? And that's the big question, right? I think.
It almost says that Amazon isn't too tied to making hardware. That they make more money from the voice services, and they would love everybody to use it. And that's pretty exciting. Well, contrast that to Google's slow reluctance to let other people use Assistant, right?
But think about how Amazon makes money. They've never made money from hardware. Hardware is just a way to get you into the Amazon ecosystem.
That's where they make the
money. So that you will pay for Prime.
Right.
Homes with the Echo, I'm trying to find the data. Those people spend a significant
orders
percentage
of magnitude.
More.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe that. I know I do. I order stuff all the time. It's gotten to the point where I'm in the bathroom and I've run out of something, you know, shaving cream or whatever, and I'll just tell Echo to order it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just easy.
Like a dash.
Does anybody
button
use the dash buttons?
I had the dash button. And then,
or was that an interim?
My 14-year no, they're still big. They're all in on the dash button.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
But my 14-year-old found our dash button, and we got a lot of toilet paper in a very brief period of time. So I had to hide it, and I forgot where I hid it. It's somewhere in the pantry. But they're actually no. In fact, there are appliance manufacturers making dishwashers and washing machines with the built-in dash button.
Yeah, well, Dash is not the Dash button was never the exciting thing. The Dash button is just the front end for the service, which is the automatic fulfillment.
Yeah.
DVS is something. Dash Replenishment Services.
That's interesting. So there is a whole technology beyond the hardware. Yeah. This isn't just like sending an order to Amazon.
No.
It's a fulfillment service. I think it is the Dash
Massive automated
service.
Warehouses and drones and whatnot.
Oh, man.
So, and if you are a manufacturer, you could actually build that into your product without ever having the dash, which is the
Look here, Dash Replenishment, DRS.
There it is.
Connected devices.
And that's an extension of Amazon's warehousing, right?
Yes.
They handle all of your fulfillment and logistics.
Running out is
an extension
really
of everything Amazon does.
Consumers.
If you have something. So these are the companies like Whirlpool that are building this thing in.
Brita, there's pet food companies.
Wow.
And
Clorox?
You know, this is Amazon has within it to be the massive IoT company. If you imagine IoT as cloud data and touching the physical world, Amazon has that chain down pretty much pat, and they're automating it quickly. So if you want to see what the future looks like in terms of like socially what AI and automation means for the economy,
yeah, they're there already.
Look at what's happening there.
Yeah.
But the good news is it's not going to impact jobs, because all of you grocery clerks, all you truck drivers, you're going to be going to the Amazon warehouse and pulling... Robot repair, because, in fact, the robots will be doing the picking anyway.
But, yeah, so, I mean...
So, at some point, and I don't think it's more than a year or two off, no human will intervene at all in this process, except maybe the UPS guy who gives you the package.
Yeah, because the drones may not be launching from their truck just yet.
Soon, though.
Yeah.
Are we going to actually have it at the point where a drone goes to the shelf, gets the object, and brings it to you? So there literally is no human involvement at all.
You will always have to have, I shouldn't say always, because that's like never, but for a significant period of time, there will be odd-shaped things, there will be weird wackadoo situations.
Oh, yeah.
So
but
people
the dash button is not for everything, right? It's for those not so odd shaped things that are easily.
Right.
Wow, what a world we live in. I'm just glad that I can't be replaced by a robot.
Voice recognition is getting better.
No, not a robot. I was going to say your competition is just a more enthusiastic young person who's on Snapchat.
Well, we always can get replaced by a young person. That's always that's always been the way of the world.
That's the way of the world.
Yeah,
that's how it works.
That's how it works. So you're going to get replaced sooner or later anyway. Any other IoT news? I don't see any IoT news here, but Stacey, this is your beat. Any other IoT news we should be aware of?
Let's see. It's all pretty small this week. I'm trying to...
We got to take advantage of your IoT.
You don't have to. I mean,
no, I want to.
I talk about it a lot on my own show, and I don't want to like overlap.
We don't want to steal people from your show at all. But but I think as a kind of a high level look at what's going on in IoT, and then if people want the deep dive, they can go to your show.
Yeah, if you want to go.
I'm
crazy.
Trying to think if there's anything new.
Last week, I talked to people about the Google Home versus the Amazon Echo, because I did an experiment where I swapped mine out for a full week to see if that Google Home
was
ready.
Which did you?
It's still the Echo.
Yeah.
Google Home still has some issues.
Yeah.
So that was a little bit of a bummer, because Google Home is so much better. So for home control, its grouping is weird. So it groups things based on... It puts things in a room. So you have the name of your particular device. So living room left table lamp would be one of my devices, of the four lights in my living room. And then I put that in the living room group. In the Echo, I have those two classifications. But then I have a future one, or a further one, called downstairs, that encompasses every light downstairs. Google doesn't give you that next level. So it was kind of irritating, because I'd be like, Google, turn off living room. Google, turn off dining room. Google, turn off kitchen.
Right.
As opposed to all that. So
but
that
it's
was
question
one.
And answer, like vocabulary and the way it handles and remembers the thing you just asked is better,
yes.
Is it not?
Yeah. That is so much better. And it has great things like, you know, being able to tie directly into a Chromecast. But I can't tie it into my Amazon Prime account.
Right.
Yeah. So... There's just silos.
I think Amazon has a 2-year lead, and I think we'll probably maintain that lead for some time. Thanks to Aseo Bra in our chat room, is, you know, the future is happening already in China. This is a Chinese factory where robots sort packages.
I watched that yesterday.
Automatically.
And the only thing humans do is put the thing on the machine.
Well, so their only job is to put it on top of it. Fulfilling job.
Isn't that great? Yeah. Well, they have to do it just right. They have to put it in just the right way.
Oh, my God. You know, what happened? We were moving away from the Henry Ford assembly line, and now we're going right back to it. Humans, apparently, only real skill is our ability to, you know, spatial and physical recognition of odd-shaped packages.
And that feels like a bone they tossed to the... like, you couldn't get a claw or something to just pick the thing up and put it on top of the machine? Come on.
They could get a claw. But how do economies survive where, you know, I mean...
We just...
And they self-recharge, too.
Oh, my God. 200,000 packages a day.
And eventually they'll be manufactured in automated plants covered only by... Yep. Wait till we start injecting everything with self-replicating nanobites. Then we're done.
I read about that.
Just what's two words, gray goo.
Yeah.
Gray goo. It's not going to work out. I've read science fiction. What are you reading these days, Stacey? What's your favorite fiction? What are you reading fictionally?
Fictionally. Oh, hold on. I got my Kindle right here. I'm like... My daughter and I are reading The Hunger Games aloud to each other.
Oh, perfect. Mm. She's the perfect age for that, isn't she?
Yeah. So go dystopia.
Yeah.
I did read Lab Girl, but that's nonfiction. So
what's that about?
Oh, it's a great book. It's a female biologist who wrote about it's a memoir of her time in science.
And nice.
It was great because I learned a lot about trees, which
I'm going to give this to my daughter who wants to be a lab girl.
Oh, yeah, you should because it actually doesn't, her experience is very, it's a woman's experience, which you don't hear a lot about, but she never actually talks about it for that should be any different, right? And every chapter begins with like this great piece of knowledge about how plants grow. So you learn a lot.
Cool.
And it was well written. I'm just trying to think of, I started
Someone
reading
the
North
chat
Water.
Room just said, Stacey is an awesome mom.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thanks.
They get to an age, though. I was reading, my kids are, of course, older, and so I was reading the Harry Potter books to them. And we got to about book 5, and Abby, who was about, I think, 12, said, "You're reading it too slow. Just give it to me."
Well, we make deals with each other that we're not going to read ahead.
Yeah, she just read it. Ellie, yeah, that's a good deal. That's a good deal. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, every time we stop, she's like, "Oh, no." And I'm like, "Sorry." Mommy's voice is giving out. But I am reading The North Water, which if you're a guy, you might like. But I was having a real hard time with it.
I'm finally getting around, speaking of guy books, I'm finally getting around to reading Blood Meridian, Cormac McCarthy's amazing book.
Yeah, you'll really like North Water then.
That's a guy. Well, that's what it reminded me of. I thought, yeah, that sounds, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ooh, The Sympathizer. That's a good book. I just read that.
What's that about?
It's about Vietnam from the perspective of a Vietnamese soldier.
Oh, this won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah. It won a Pulitzer. It's a good book.
Oh, okay. It's good enough. It's good enough.
But it was a really good book.
What you reading, Matthew?
I'm reading Seven Eves.
Love that. I was just thinking about
Neal
that.
Neal Stephenson, yeah.
Matthew, is that your daughter?
Yeah. Megan, wave to the camera.
Hi, Megan.
Stacey says
taking
hi.
Taking care of the cat. At the
moment. I don't know why I'm saying that because she can't hear me any better than she can hear you.
I know. I'm just so excited. I'm like, I've known Matthew
everyone
for
is
so
saying
long.
Hi to you.
She was a little girl, I bet, when you first
met. Oh,
yeah, littler.
Littler. Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves is a very good science fiction book.
Really and well done.
The premise is, and it's not spoiling anything to say, it begins with... The moon breaking up into pieces and the consequences on Earth. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know what the name of the movie, of the book means until really almost the end.
Until the end, yeah.
And then it's like, wow, highly recommend it. Very good book.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating in the beginning when the moon explodes and everyone thinks, wow, that's really cool. Look at all the little pieces of the moon. And and even the guy who's like the chief scientist of the U.S.
There's a Neil deGrasse Tyson character in it.
Yeah, exactly. And he's thinking, wow, that's pretty amazing. And he's going on talk shows and he's talking about it. And then he has this horrible realization that eventually all of those pieces are going to come falling down. And it's going to be very, 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 very bad.
And that's all we need to say. Audible has it. I listened on audiobooks, but boy, I love Neal Stephenson. He's had some misses.
Me too.
Reem D was not great. He's had a couple of near misses lately.
I went back and read Snow Crash, actually. I think it was last year.
Great.
And it's funny how William Gibson, who knows a thing or two about science fiction and the future, had a tweet the other day. Do you remember a guy sent an animated GIF to a Newsweek writer and triggered his epilepsy?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this William Gibson said that was the first thing he thought of was Snow Crash, because that was the closest that he could think of to a sort of virus that is replicated and distributed basically on the net. So I thought it was interesting.
That's interesting. William Gibson is great dismal on Twitter. He has one of the best mm-hmm. Twitter handles ever.
Must follow.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah, we're big fans.
And Canadian.
Of his stuff.
Although, he's Canadian?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm like, you guys are producing all kinds of great dystopian.
He's in Vancouver. No. In fact.
Pretty sure he's Canadian.
Yeah, he is. Okay. At Paul Allen's Experience Music Project, they have I can't remember which novel it is. And maybe it's Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon. But.
Another great one.
But is it Gibson or Gibson types it? Neil writes it, handwrites his novels. And yeah. So it must have been Neal Stephenson. And it has a pile, like 5 foot high pile manuscript of the handwritten manuscript. And then all the pens, the pilot pens, fountain pens he went through. It's the best display I ever saw. It's awesome.
Amazing.
I don't know. You were two of the smartest people I know. I thought, I wonder what they're reading. It's not a normal feature of this show, but I just thought, what the heck?
No, it's a great feature. I'm going to go look for those books.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I will recommend a great book. I don't know if our audience will like it or not. It's kind of a fantasy. It's by a guy who's very famous for his short stories, but he's 57 years old and he had never written a novel. And his first novel just came out. His name is George Sanders, and the novel is Lincoln and the Bardo.
Oh, you and the New Yorker. Good Lord.
This is amazing novel.
All of the intelligentsia is like, this is an amazing novel.
This novel I have it on my list. Is so different and weird and brilliant. And this is actually a good one to listen on audio because they recorded it with 186 different voice actors, including Nick Offerman, who has a large part in it. Of course, Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec. David Sedaris, Carrie Brownstein. It's Lena Dunham's in it. The cast is 186 characters because there are a lot of people and there's a lot of dialogue in it. It's a very... I don't want to say a word about what it's about. And don't read any of the synopses because it's much more interesting just to not know what you're reading and then figure it out as you're listening. Highly recommend that as an Audible book. And, of course, there's the whole Bill O'Reilly collection.
Yeah.
Available now. Remainder bins everywhere.
Yeah. Actually, Bill will come to your house and read it to you.
He's done with his day job.
Yeah. He'll have a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah.
I had to share that video clip, which you probably don't want to play because they're swearing. But
we'll do it live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll do it live.
Yeah.
I kill myself laughing every time.
It's very funny.
I've seen it a million times. It is so funny.
Well, but anybody who's worked in my business recognizes.
What does that mean?
Totally.
I don't know what it means.
It means he's trying to record something for use in the show.
I know.
He's saying, what does it mean?
And when he's saying it, I don't know what it means.
I don't know what it means. Let's do it live. I can't say it. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
We'll do it live.
Oh, it's so good.
It's a little too close to home for me. I can't really. I can't really laugh. You know what? You guys did such a good job in your book reports. I'm going to get you snacks.
What?
We get snack time. It's snack time, and then it'll be nap time right after. Yeah. I'm sorry. I can't really thrusties down the wire to you, but it's time for Nature Box. These snacks arrive at your door. It used to be monthly, but now you can, you know, and it was a fixed number of snacks. Now you can order as much as you want, as often as you want. There's no minimum purchase. You can cancel any time. And these are the best snacks ever. This one's already opened, the blueberry almond quinoa bites. And one of the things I like about this, they're really good. If you have a desire for a salty, crunchy snack, but you don't want to eat like Cheetos.
Which I do. So,
yeah.
I don't.
This is healthy for you. Roasted cashews, crispy rice, pumpkin seeds, roasted almonds, dried blueberries, rice syrup, cane sugar, quinoa, palm oil, sesame seeds, natural blueberry flavor, and sea salt. And they're incredible. And they satisfy, you know, they check off all the boxes.
You're killing me.
But but one of the things you can do is they all have resealable bags, so you don't have to overeat, right? And they're nice. They're usually very healthy size. These are not like the, you know, the 8 chip bags you buy in the grocery store. Naked trail mix, nuts, raisins, seeds, and dried fruit. And when I say nuts, raisins, seeds, listen what's in it. Peanuts, raisins, almonds, roasted pumpkin seeds, dried apples, cashews, peanut oil, salt. That's it. That's all there is. And that's what I love about Nature Box. They are making, there's over 100 snacks to choose from. Sweet, savory, spicy. You pick the snacks you want. They'll deliver them right to your door. If ever you get a snack you don't like, they'll replace it for free in your next box. It is awesome. High-quality ingredients.
Sriracha. Oh,
they do a lot of sriracha stuff that's so good. Highly recommend it. Actually, one of the favorites, and I was listening to another podcast. I think it was Joe Rogan's or something. He was talking about Nature Box, and he said his favorite was the Big Island pineapple, and that's my favorite, too. It's the best dried pineapple you ever had. That's all that's in this. No sulfites, nothing. In fact, all of Nature Box snacks are free from artificial colors, flavors, or sweeteners, so you can feel great about snacking. Your daughter would love these. And, you know, snacks are an important part of growing up, but let's not go to the vending machine and stock up on things that aren't going to be... How about this? Nutty power clusters, nut squares with walnuts, almonds, and cashews. Of course, if you have a nut allergy, you don't have, they don't all have nuts in them. Just great stuff. Nature Box. Here's the deal. Right now, you're going to save 50% on your first order. So there's no reason not to when you go to naturebox.com/twit. Naturebox.com/twit. 50% off your first order. Nature Box. It's my favorite part of the day. Nature Box snack time. Now, everybody get out your mats. And we're going to take a nap. No, we're not going to take a nap. We're going to get your picks of the week. Did we do the Google Draw thing?
We did it last week.
We did do it. Okay.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure that we did not miss that because that is so much fun. Well, I'll let you guys. I have another Google, new thing from Google, but I'll let you guys go first.
First?
State. Yes. Is that yours?
Oh, sorry. Damn. That was going to be mine. Yeah.
That could be yours. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's do it right now.
Okay. Yeah.
And then we'll get Stacy's pick of the week. So Google Earth rolled out brand new. Tell us about it, Matt.
It's amazing. I saw somebody tweeted a link and they said, oh, there's a new Google Earth. And I thought, big deal. Like, we've seen Google Earth. What's, you know, so what? I think it's great and everything. But it stepped it up. Like, there's much more. I had just been in Italy, and I went to a bunch of places that I had been and zoomed in and panned around and looked at the, it's phenomenal. Like, it's significantly more.
Well, let's go to Perugia right now, zooming in. So you've got your knowledge cards.
Yeah.
What else is different here?
There's, I found the motion in this, I don't know if this part is new, but it was much more seamless.
Yeah, it's really, really nicely done.
Yeah, like the panning and zooming, the kind of not scrolling, but however you call it, in a sort of 3D.
Stacy and I, by the way, are extremely jealous.
Oh yeah,
we want to go to Perugia. Yeah,
you should. It's a fascinating. I had no idea. Like, it was the capital of the Etruscan Empire. I mean, it was a big deal.
It's, it looks so medieval.
Back in the day.
It's in Umbria. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was at war at one point with Assisi. In fact, if I remember correctly, St. Francis was in the war and then he got injured. And that's when he went back to Assisi and became a monk.
I've always loved Google Earth.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It was like I saw it for the first time again.
Yeah.
And I was amazed all over again.
Yeah. This is like looking down from an airplane. I mean,
it's really great.
And it's fast.
Now, have you seen Lion yet?
Yes.
That's a great movie. The story of an Indian orphan who gets lost when he's only, I think, 5 years old or very young.
Yeah.
Gets on a train, loses his brother, ends up thousands of miles away from home, completely lost, becomes a street urchin, is adopted by an Australian family, but still can never get over the idea that he lost his mother and his brother and his sister.
And then Google Earth comes along at just the right moment and someone tells him about it. And I remember that news story. I remember reading about
me
it
too.
And thinking that's incredible because it was such a powerful story. And it's an amazing movie.
So he uses really Google Earth because he can only remember, you know, he's got the name wrong of the town.
Yeah.
He can't figure it out. So he just figures out what the radius would be of his, you know, how far the train went.
It took him months, years, I think.
Really a neat story and a beautiful movie that was nominated.
It was so incredible. I remember thinking that can't possibly be true.
Right.
Like it seems almost fictional.
Amazing.
It actually happened.
Yeah. Ooh, we just zoomed in on the 12 Apostles Visitor Center off Port Campbell National Park in Victoria, Australia. This is really remarkable. You really feel... So this is the dice over in the left. There's a die, and you click it, and you get a random spot. That's fun, too. I think for a kid...
And there's some guides. There's like, oh, yeah, as a kid, this would be incredible.
My daughter, when she was young, she loved Google Earth. Like, she would spend hours just playing with it on a tablet, and we showed her this and she's just like, wow.
Wait a minute, she would like this. Girl Muppets Around the World. What?
Okay.
I get it. So here's an Afghanistan.
They're different nationalities.
Different Muppet nationalities.
It's just so seamless. Like before, you know, it was laggy or blocky and you would kind of lose the illusion in a way.
Right.
It's just so seamless.
This is
like technology. Even zooming to that level.
Yeah.
This is
technology that's just.
And I remember Google Earth, the original, when it was Keyhole. I remember seeing a demo, and it was one of those things where I actually told somebody from Google this in Perugia. It was one of those moments where I felt like I was living in the future, like where all of a sudden, you know, faster than light travel appears or something. Like it just felt so different and so futuristic, and yet there it was, and it was free. It's pretty incredible when you think about it.
It's just remarkable. You want to explore Paris? Well, we'd all like
dude, lost civilizations from above.
Oh, wait a minute. We're going to Machu Picchu in a couple of months. I wonder if that's a lost
civilization. Paris is cool, but
lost civilizations? How about Nabata Playa? Between 7,000 and 6,500 BCE, an urban community arose in what is currently the Egyptian. Now, what do I do to see more of it? Do I click this? I don't know.
Just click indiscriminately.
Zoom in.
That's all you get. That's it.
That's it? Well, that's a fascinating.
No, I'm just kidding.
I don't know. You might. Let's double click.
Kind of looks like an abstract painting.
Yeah, it's pretty. You can, in parts, I mean, there are some amazing things like camels. And there's shadows trekking across the desert that you can see. More lost civilizations. Let's do another.
I remember we used to look for the glitches or the hidden things, or you know, there was a woman sunbathing or something.
Right.
Everybody in the newsroom, just like work stopped while everybody looked for all the little Easter eggs in Google Earth.
Is it making
there was one where cars looked like they were levitating in a parking lot because of the way the shadows.
Right.
My dad is on Google Earth.
Your dad is? What's he doing there?
Yeah. I'm sorry. He's on Google Street View. Sorry.
Oh, he's standing outside the house?
No, he's driving
his car.
Street
View was another great one, too.
Yeah.
Street View, actually, when it came out, someone I won't name who I worked with was shocked and horrified and screamed bloody murder. And I said, what is the matter? And she said, if you go to my house... The car was driving by just as she bent over into her car to get the groceries out.
She's hanging out.
And
of the
so
car
literally
window.
All you see is her butt.
It's her butt.
And she said, it's going to take like a year for them to go back and reindex.
Oh.
So I said, you could send an email and beg them to like come down your street again.
This you're actually seeing Tulum.
See, look at that. That's
This is the street view. So it's the next step, right? Wow. And you know, with all these 360 degree cameras and stuff out there, at some point, this is just you're going to be able to go anywhere and see anything.
And you already can. I mean, there's not even just streets, but they've got guys carrying them on their backs and people on scooters and like unicycles. Camels. Like you can get street view almost anywhere.
Right.
Inside shopping.
Is it a Scottish island that has them on sheep or something? Is that?
They have street view.
They have way more sheep than they do people. That's for sure. Wow.
Yeah. It was like street view cameras on sheep. I want to say
So it's sheep view.
Sheep view. Not
cameras on sheep. Someone help me out here because the Faroe Islands.
Okay. Yeah. There's nobody there.
Yeah. They have to use sheep.
There's like four people and a bunch of sheep.
This is neat. One of the most mysterious human structures ever built.
Sheep view.
Oh, so it wasn't Google. It wasn't Google that did it. It was. Yeah.
That's funny. That's funny.
Sheep view. All right, Stacey, IoT. So this was both Matthew and my pick. What's your pick of the week?
So, you know how we have this Punch Leo button that we've been joking about?
Yeah, we really want to make. Yeah.
Yeah, the virtual.
So here. Yeah. Here is, now this is not, this can't be done over Wi-Fi yet, but it would be simple to add a Wi-Fi shield and program it.
Yeah.
So this is a Hackster.io project to create a fist bumping robot. And Leo, I don't think you want the punch to actually be that hard. So we just have to make the fist bump instead of the punch is more like a fist bump, or we could put a stronger servo and make that work.
Well, wait a minute, though. Here on Instructables, the instructions for building a desktop fist bumper, I think this actually would do the job.
There you go.
That would work.
The idea being, it needs to come out faster.
Yeah.
We could probably step it up.
Spring load it.
It's an Arduino. Look at that.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you spring loaded it, you wouldn't need the servo.
Oh, you're right. To release the fist. And then it would just...
All right, so I'm going to look at different instructable things.
You'd have to rely on my staff to...
Shove it back in.
And to not replace the spring with something really, really powerful.
Yeah. This is...
actually have to rely on your staff. You would.
This is 3D printable. You can print this. And then, of course, there's a lot of, you know what? I search for fist bumper, but there's a lot of this stuff. Arduino. Yeah.
That's a powerful human need.
It to either bump or
to bump punch. Fists.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. We thank, of course, Jeff Jarvis, who had to leave to go on to other things at F8, but he took some time out from his very busy schedule there to join us. Also to Stacey Higginbotham, who also took time out from her very busy schedule to join us. You can find more of Stacey at StaceyOnIoT.com and her podcast, the IoT Podcast, at IoTPodcast.com. Matthew Ingram writes for Fortune. He is, are you going to the lake soon? It's getting to be lake weather.
Soon. Man. Very soon.
We were all talking about you and your lake pictures and how jealous we are of that. Well, you got to have
some. I can't talk now. I'm in a canoe on the lake.
There's lots of room. It's a big lake.
I'll come up. We'll come up and visit. We could do the show from the lake. What's the name of the lake?
Yeah. It's called Golden Lake.
Oh, no. Stacey, can you go, the loans, Leo, the loans.
Oh. Okay.
On Golden Lake. Poop.
Yes.
You old poop.
You old, oh, man, you old pope. We do this show every Wednesday, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to join us, please do. You can watch live or even email tickets at twit.tv and join us in studio. Of course, our chat room is always open at irc.twit.tv. On-demand video and audio always available after the fact on our website, twit.tv/twig, and wherever you get your podcasts. Last day to vote tomorrow, I guess, is the last day to vote for the Webbies. I don't know. When is the deadline? Is it midnight tonight or midnight tomorrow? We would really appreciate it. It's neck and neck. We are fighting tooth and nail against Marketplace for the People's Choice Technology Podcast and the Webby Awards. Man, I want to win this one. But these marketplace people, they're using the power, the mighty power of American Public Radio to solicit votes. All I got is this here podcast. So tell a friend. We actually have a short URL you can use, twit.to/webbies2017. And your votes are appreciated. It's like we're literally a couple of percentage points between us. This is worse than the Georgia 6th. This is close. Actually, it's a lot worse than Georgia 6th, which wasn't close at all. You can vote more than once if you have more than one email address, but I would personally never tell you to do that. Thanks for thanks for joining us.
Should I tell them, Leo? I have no dog in this.
Yeah, tell them.
You can use your Twitter account, your Facebook account, and an email address or two. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.